The Guardian.
If you're looking to get in shape, build your fitness, and improve your well-being, then all you need is a decent pair of running shoes, a bit of determination, and the brand new Guardian Guide to Running podcasts. Our 8-week program will transform you from complete running novice to someone who's able to run for 30 minutes non-stop. And if you're a more experienced runner and want to take things to the next level, then we've also got 4 special runs for you in our advanced running guides. The Guardian Guide to Running podcasts, available now on iTunes and theguardian.com.
Welcome to Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. This week's show is about a very strange sleep condition known as sleep paralysis. Professor of Psychology at Goldsmiths College London, Dr. Christopher French, and filmmaker Carlin McKinnon are part of the Sleep Paralysis Project. They've combined artistic and scientific understanding of the condition to shine a light on this little understood neurological error in our normal waking pattern. Chris and Carla came into the studio to discuss the condition and its effects. But first, let's hear a clip from Carla's often terrifying film titled Devil in the Room.
Stop holding me down. Crush. Screaming and asking for help, but your mouth isn't moving.
I started to cry out to Jesus and I couldn't even say his name. I said,
And then next thing I know is there's this woman on top of me.
There was a woman sitting up, levitated in bed next to me. She looked dead.
Chris, let me start with you. Can you tell us what sleep paralysis is?
Well, in its most basic form, which is fairly common, I mean, estimates vary, but between 20 and 40% of the population will have experienced this. It's when you're kind of half awake and half asleep and you realise that you can't move. And it typically will last for just a few seconds and then you snap out of it. It's a little bit disconcerting, but it's most people don't think
it's quite familiar. It's sort of early in the morning when you're trying to get up and you find yourself unable to move. And it's quite frightening, actually.
I mean, again, bear in mind, most people have never even experienced that. I mean, 60% plus of the population never even get that. But a sizable proportion do get that. They will know what we're talking about now.
And so, you know, is it just a passing thing? Or, I mean, of course it isn't, because you've got a whole project on this now. What mythologically, I mean, culturally speaking, what have we thought this was?
Well, the thing is that in about 5% of the population, you get other associated symptoms that make the whole experience much, much scarier. So you'll get a sense of presence. You'll feel as if there's something or someone in the room with you, and whoever or whatever that thing is, they don't mean you any good at all. And you may actually hallucinate. You may see dark shadows moving around the room or lights or even monstrous, grotesque figures coming towards you. You may hear voices or footsteps. You may hear mechanical sounds. You may feel as if you're being touched or held or even dragged out of the bed. It can turn into a full-blown out-of-body experience. Now, obviously, if you get that form of it, and particularly if you get it on a regular basis, then it's very, very scary and people will look for some kind of explanation. Now, historically, people have interpreted it within the belief system of their time, and so back in the Middle Ages, it was interpreted as being sex-crazed demons who would come and have their wicked way with the sleeper. The male version was called the incubus and the female version was the succubus. And even to this day, in societies where they do have a label for it, then it will typically be some kind of supernatural interpretation. You can see why that would be. So Newfoundland, they talk about the old hag who comes and sits on the sleeper's chest to suffocate them. In Japan, it's Kanashibari, again, a nocturnal spirit attack. One of my favourites, because it's very, very creepy, is in St. Lucia, it's Kokmar, which is the spirits of unbaptised children that crawl onto the sleeper's chest to throttle them.
Carla, in your film, you sort of try and evoke some of these spirits with animations and various scary-looking puppets. How widely varying are these things? I mean, how interesting is it to sort of get these things together?
Well, there are a huge amount of myths and legends that involve something or someone visiting you in the night. I think it's fair to say that not all of these are, or they're not completely bound to sleep paralysis. There may be other cultural reasons why these kind of things develop. But the ones that I wanted to choose for the film were some of the more offbeat ones. So I've included the old hag of Newfoundland because she's a bit of a classic. She comes in.
Does she have a particular look, or did you just choose any old hag?
Well, I found it quite difficult to decide what to make her look like. People report different things. Often there'll be long matted hair, often a kind of a wrinkled and gnarled face. I didn't want to include anything that seemed to have an external character because it's a very short film and I wanted to keep it simple. So I actually made a cast of the actress's face, the sleeper's face, and then created a kind of a gnarled, mutated sort of version of the actress who was playing the sleeper. So she was kind of, the idea is that she was being visited by something which was external, but was also a manifestation of something internal.
I mean, what's the difference between these sorts of visions and just your bog standard nightmare?
Well, for a start, they feel very different. I mean, people will tell you that they were not asleep, they were not dreaming. And in a sense, that is actually true. That's supported by the kind of psychophysiological evidence. When people are having these kinds of experiences, they are typically in the REM state, the rapid eye movement state, that is typically associated with vivid dreams. And when you're in that state, the muscles of your body are actually paralysed, presumably to stop you acting out the actions of the dream.
So it might be worth just going through here. What happens during normal sleep? What are your various phases and when do you dream and why is this being interrupted?
Yeah, it's interesting really that we, pretty much all of us, go through sleep paralysis every night, but we're usually not consciously aware of it, because the typical sleep cycle, it takes, as you go into sleep, you'll go through stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, your breathing rate changes, your heart rate changes, your brain waves change, and then you come back up through these stages, and then you go into REM sleep and rapid eye movement sleep. That, as I said, is the phase of sleep that's associated with vivid dreams, and the muscles of the body are actually paralysed then. Now, normally you're not consciously aware of it because you're consciously aware of what you're dreaming. Your mind is in the dream world. You'll then go back through those phases again in about 90-minute cycles, and as you go through the night, the proportion of REM sleep increases and the proportion of non-REM sleep decreases. What is happening in sleep paralysis is that something's going a little bit wrong, and you, putting it very simply, it's as though your mind's woken up but your body hasn't. And so you're aware of the fact that you're paralysed. You can also see your surroundings. You can in that sense, you're not asleep. You can see that you're in your bedroom, but it also appears as if some of the kind of dream imagery is coming through into normal waking consciousness, and your mind's trying its best to make sense of this very, very confusing situation, and the result is these terrifying hallucinations.
So the other side of that, of course, is sleepwalking, isn't it? Your body is moving, but you're not actually awake mentally.
Well, that's it. I mean, there are other kind of sleep disorders that sometimes people confuse with sleep paralysis, like night terrors, for example. With night terrors, people wake up screaming, maybe running around the room, trying to climb the walls, getting away from something that's incredibly terrifying. So obviously they're not paralysed. And the other thing is they don't remember it the next day. Whereas people who experience sleep paralysis can't move and they do remember it the next day.
And how common is sleep paralysis, where you're sort of lying there imagining, I don't know, hags or black cats or, you know, scary ghosts and monsters?
It is surprisingly common. Estimates vary. It depends on how you ask the question. But, I mean, a typical estimate would be about 5% of the population will experience it at least once, and a smaller proportion actually experience it on a regular basis, can have it several times a month. It is one of the standard symptoms of narcolepsy, for example, but it also does occur in non-narcoleptics.
Are there particular risk factors that people have that predispose them to these things?
Anything that disturbs the normal sleep cycle. If you are susceptible to sleep paralysis, then going on a long-haul flight, doing night shifts, partying all night, mind-altering substances, alcohol, I mean, all the things that make life fun, basically, are going to make you more likely to have a sleep paralysis episode. And also, interestingly, sleeping on your back. You're much more likely to have an attack of sleep paralysis if you sleep on your back than if you sleep on your side or on your front. And there's a classic image by Fuseli called The Nightmare from the 1780s. I think a lot of people would have recognised that picture if they saw it. And again, the sleeper is she's on her back in that picture, and it's a clearly a depiction, an artistic depiction of sleep paralysis.
I really hope no one's listening to this in bed right now as they're trying to get to sleep. I'd be frightened beyond belief. Carlo, so tell me more about the purpose of the Sleep Paralysis Project, which the film is part of. The film Devil in the Room is part of the Sleep Paralysis Project. Well, what did you want to raise issues about?
So I've been getting sleep paralysis since I was quite young, with quite frightening experiences, often thinking there's somebody in the room with me, thinking there's somebody in the bed with me, hearing a lot of noises, sometimes hearing people talking about killing me. And I used to think it was real, and then I just thought it was a very strange kind of form of dream. But it was very difficult for me to believe that there wasn't something supernatural about it. And I started learning about sleep paralysis not until my mid-20s. And when I did, everything started making a lot more sense. It was so counterintuitive that it took me a while to actually accept that this was something normal and this was something that could be explained. And then I became quite shocked that that there was so little information out about it. So I decided to do this project. I was getting quite extreme cases of sleep paralysis a couple of times a week. I would wake up and there'd be something happening and I wouldn't be able to move. And
how do you get yourself out of that situation?
Well, people have different techniques. Often you just can't. You have to just sit it out. But there are ways to make it less acute and unpleasant. So, I mean, the key thing is to try and stay calm, which is much easier said than done, because everything that's happening feels so incredibly real. Some people find that they can, if they focus very, very hard, they can move maybe a finger or move their head slightly, and by doing that they can kind of break the paralysis. Personally, I find that actually really focusing on what's happening physically, so putting it into words, saying my fingers are tingling, I'm lying on my back, my arm is behind me, absolutely doing an inventory of what's going on with you physically, and so that you can cross-reference when you wake up all the things you believe to be real against all the things which are actually happening.
So you're in control of your thoughts, and you know what's going on.
Absolutely. Your thinking is as if you're awake. It's as if you're lying in bed and you're awake, but the whole world around you has shifted slightly into a terrifying parallel reality.
So you the project itself is an attempt to get more information to people out there, what, to share experiences? And
it's a combination. I wanted to be able to creatively explore the experience. I wanted to make a film which had one foot in being a horror film and one foot in being a science documentary. And I wanted to open a door through that film to some much more hard information about it. So there's an online resource, and I've done a series of events about it. And I'm trying to just raise awareness for all the research behind it. What I found through doing it is I've been contacted by a lot of people, particularly in America, who have had terrible, terrible experiences with sleep paralysis and have been convinced that the explanation is that they're being attacked by the devil, usually, sometimes ghosts, sometimes aliens, but often the devil or demons. And so the more I do the project, the more I actually see a need for it.
And so Chris, how serious can this get? I mean, it's one thing to say that you are asleep and you feel these things and you're frightened, but physically, does it have any effects afterwards? I mean, should we be worried about this if you get these effects?
In general, I mean, the message that I'd really want to put out there is exactly as Carl has just said, that sleep paralysis can be absolutely terrifying, but it is essentially harmless. Now, having said that, there are real risks attached, because lots of people have never heard of this term, sleep paralysis. And so in terms of trying to make sense of it, They're looking for an explanation. And so some people end up being convinced, as Carla said, that they're being attacked by demons. Others believe that they've been abducted by aliens. And even if you go to your GP and tell them about these symptoms, your GP may well not have heard of sleep paralysis. And I know of cases of people who've been misdiagnosed, put onto medication that really wasn't appropriate.
Misdiagnosed as
well?
Well,
often as schizophrenics. I mean, if you go to your GP and you say that demons come into my room every night and rape me, I mean, and that sensation of being raped is very common amongst female sufferers. There's often a very strong sexual component. Not always, but there often is. Then again, if your GP has never heard of this thing called sleep paralysis, it's easy to see how a misdiagnosis might actually
occur. That's even more frightening, actually, in a sense, because then you're going down a sort of treatment path, which is a psychological psychiatric path, which is very strange and different to what you should be on, of course.
I mean, I'm sure Carla's had the same experience as I have. I've received emails from people who've come across, say, that the piece that I did for The Guardian on sleep paralysis on the science pages. And that's the first time they've ever realised that anyone else in the world suffers from this and that they're not insane. And typically people don't even talk about it because they know that if they tell their friends and family, if their friends and family have never experienced it themselves, they may well think you need to go and see a psychiatrist, there's something wrong with you. And so we're trying to get the message out there that it is essentially harmless.
Why is it predominantly that it's fear that people get in these situations? Why not other emotions?
I think the situation is that there's reasonable grounds to suppose that the amygdala, the part of the brain that deals with fear and coping with threats, is actually activated as an integral part of the whole thing. So it's not that, I mean, you might think that, well, hang on, if you think that you're being attacked by these weird monsters and you can't move and blah, blah, isn't fear a perfectly rational response? But it would appear that I think we can plausibly argue that it's probably the case that the amygdala itself is overactivated, and that's what's generating this kind of hyper-arousal, this amazing...
I suppose I'm curious, why is it the situations aren't more pleasurable? Like, you know, you're on a sunny day or something and there's wind blowing through your hair and something like that.
Well, again, I think that there is an under-researched... I think it's an important question. I think there's an under-researched area which relates to more positive sleep paralysis experiences. I mean, in the same way that near-death experiences are always presented or typically presented as being very, very positive, and then subsequent research showed that actually sometimes people have negative near-death experiences. They are the minority, but they're there. It's the flip side here. Most sleep paralysis episodes are absolutely terrifying, but occasionally you will get people who will report blissful experiences. I think a lot of angelic encounters are probably the kind of blissful, positive form of sleep paralysis.
I've also interviewed a few people who have positive experiences with it. One guy who has trained himself through sleep paralysis to get into out-of-body experiences and what he perceives as astral projection experiences. He now does this every day. It's kind of a hobby. Another guy I interviewed who has extremely blissful experiences but finds them as disturbing as the terror, because he says that what he enters is a kind of a feedback loop of bliss where the bliss builds and builds and escalates and he has absolutely no control over it. So although he's euphoric, he feels so completely caught in that emotion that he finds it as disturbing and unsettling as any other.
And I imagine also that if you've got lack of control over the whole thing, that's also at some point frightening anyway. Mm-hmm. So, Carla, is your intent to try and get as many people as possible to recognise that these things are not supernatural, that with a few maybe inventorying or whatever else, a few techniques, you can just relax, sort of deal with it yourself?
I'm trying to keep quite an open dialogue. So the information that I'm presenting is largely scientific and psychological and neurobiological. But I've also had... given platform to psychoanalysts who have often a slightly different take on it. A lot of people who've become drawn into the project will write their own coping mechanisms, which are often spiritual or religious, and I try and, as much as possible, open the project up to that, to those voices while managing it. I'm not trying to convince everybody out of their belief systems, but I would like to offer a alternative narrative for what might be happening to you, because I think for me, certainly, it made things a lot easier to manage.
So what's next for the project? The Devil in the Room is sort of an 8-ish minute film at the moment. What are your plans for it?
Well, it's going to be going around some festivals this year. It's going to Encounters and the London International Animation Festival. And also screening at places like the Narcolepsy UK Annual Conference.
What kind of responses do you get, actually, when you show the film to
people? A lot of people find it frightening.
It is quite frightening. Even I found it frightening.
I find that reassuring, because I did want to do something which, to some extent, captured the experience and showed how real it can seem. Some people find it funny. And it gets a really diverse range of reactions. I think people who've had sleep paralysis respond very well to it, and people who haven't, it's a mixed bag. But what I'd like to do next is actually some of the people who've contacted me and who I've been in touch with over the course of the project who have these extraordinary stories, I'd like to actually meet them in person and scale it up to a longer form documentary and a project which goes into a lot more depth with the individual stories around sleep paralysis.
And how do they contact you? It's your website is...
Through the website, which is thesleepparalysisproject.org.
Just finally, Chris, it might be worth just going through the advice you'd give to someone who maybe thinks they have sleep paralysis. What do you do?
This is one of the big problems, that there's not been any systematic research in terms of systematically looking at possible coping strategies and also techniques to try to actually minimise the frequency. And I think that is there's a real need for research of that kind. So we're relying here on anecdotes. We're relying on what people tell us. But in terms of trying to minimise the frequency, then the advice would definitely be just to follow a healthy routine in terms of your sleep patterns. Basically, try and keep regular hours when you go to sleep. Avoid anything that might disrupt your sleep, like alcohol or caffeine late at night. Don't sleep on your back. Some people have actually adopted a strategy of kind of sewing walnuts into the back of their pyjamas so that they can't sleep on the back. It's too uncomfortable. It makes you turn over onto your side. All of those things.
Why are walnuts?
Well, it could be tennis balls. I mean, you can go for it. I just thought walnuts, you know.
You just find bits of walnut in your bed afterwards.
Exactly. And that's uncomfortable. You're not going to sleep on your back then either.
Or your front.
If it does happen, then, I mean, again, some people, they seem to be a lucky minority, I would say, have actually adopted a strategy of trying to just lay back and enjoy it, just enjoy the ride. Other people who say, I know when it's happening that it's sleep paralysis. I'm fully aware of the fact that it's sleep paralysis, but I still can't do anything about the terror. It's still... These are people who have in real life maybe faced life-threatening situations, and they say the terror they experience during sleep paralysis is orders of magnitude worse than that. And even though they know it's sleep paralysis, they cannot overcome that fear.
There's some people in the world who love horror movies. So for them, it might be something like, this is my own personal... I'm not trying to dismiss anything here.
But it's actually true. Some people can actually do that. Yeah. And you can see, reading the accounts that you get, they're so wonderful and vivid and creative. You can see why it appeals to artistic people as well. You know, I mean, there's a long history of sleep paralysis cropping up in visual art, in literature. I mean, one of my students came up with this. When he had an episode, he'd woken up and there was a cat next to the bed and it was hissing at him and he couldn't move. Now, that'd be quite spooky, agreed? Yeah. But this wasn't an ordinary cat. Instead of an ordinary cat's head, it had a cat's skull that was inverted, and black goo was dripping from the mouth. And you think, where did that come from? But that's the kind of thing that crops up.
It's also quite frightening what the brain can do to you, not only in the imagery it produces, which is quite shocking when we talk about it, but the fact that it can convince you that something is so real.
Absolutely.
It's a very...
I mean, there is a line in Carla's film where I'm just in a bit of voiceover saying, but it's not real. And then another voice comes in and says, yes, but it feels real. And that's what Matt says. And that is the case. I mean, when you're there and it's happening to you, it's absolutely terrifying, even if you do know it's sleep paralysis.
And that is the thing, of course, isn't it? The brain makes you think it actually is real, even if you consciously know it isn't. But that just shows you the amount of illusion your brain creates for you of the real world.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much, Carla and Chris. The links to the Sleep Paralysis Project are going to be on our blog. And we'll look forward to the longer version and more frightening version of the film, Carla. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll be posting a short version of that film on our website. For links and information, just go to theguardian.com/scienceweekly. For more information on the Sleep Paralysis Project, funded by the Wellcome Trust, just go to thesleepparalysisproject.com. And of course, we'll have links on the blog for this podcast as well. This edition of Science Weekly is the last before we take a short summer break. We'll be back in September, but meanwhile, from me, Alok Jha, producer Jason Phipps, and the science team here at The Guardian, thanks for listening. Don't have nightmares.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.